Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Runners Only with Dom Harvey, brought to you by Radix Nutrition. Coming up, John Hart.
As I said to you, I was a bit dubious about doing it, but yeah. I've really enjoyed it. Just talking to you has made me reflect a lot on my life, and there's been a lot go on there, you know, and to be fair, 90% of it's positive.
Yeah, John Hart, legendary rugby coach, former coach of the All Blacks, and a man that retired with a win record of 84.5%. This is John's first ever podcast experience. He's been asked to do them in the past. This is the first one he's agreed to, and I can't thank him enough for that. He keeps his head down these days by choice, so I can't thank him enough for coming over to chat, especially about some of the less sexy stuff, like the 1999 Rugby World Cup and the fallout after the All Blacks did not win. I thoroughly enjoyed meeting and spending time with John, and I hope you guys do too. Thanks so much to Radix Nutrition for sponsoring this episode. Without their support, it simply would not be possible to keep bringing you these conversations. I'll be honest with you, it's a fair amount of work each week, and their investment is crucial. I only tell you this so that you might be compelled to check out what they're all about, and if you like what you see, maybe become a customer. I almost guarantee you that once you try their products, you will become a fan. They are that good. RadixNutrition.co.nz. That's RADIX. RadixNutrition.co.nz. Okay, let's get into it. John Hart on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Fast pace, slow and steady, anywhere you coming. Just want to connect for everyone who loves running. Hey, Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
How often do you show these? What's your program?
Hey, what's that?
What's your program? When do you put this out?
Each Monday an episode comes out. Mm-hmm. We're on now. John Hart, hello. Welcome to Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Hi, Dom. I don't know how you got Runners Only and you got me.
Well,
I
launched the podcast at the beginning of 2022, and it was like a run. I thought, I'm so late to the podcast game, I need like a niche. And I love running, so I thought everyone's got some connection to running. So it started off with that as a niche, but it sort of evolved quite a bit.
Yeah, it's great.
Probably time for a rebrand.
Yeah, I'm not sure. If you're expecting me to run, yes, it is.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming over. I tried to research you online. Is this your first ever podcast?
Yes, it is. I've been probably pretty quiet in recent times and out of the public eye, but working hard at the things I love and enjoying retirement or semi-retirement and, having fun.
A lot of players that you coached over the years would find it very hard to believe that you've been quiet. is that fair?
I can't believe that.
I want to start, maybe a little icebreaker here.
He'll be a good guest, absolute cracker of a talker. And the first thing I would say about John Hart, New Zealand Rugby is very, very lucky to have him as coach in 1996. That's when the game went professional. Hardy had 25 years odd corporate experience with Fletcher Challenge, so knew everything about a work-life balance, knew everything about contracting, just sorting out both on and off-field affairs, so we were bloody lucky to have him there, and super, super organised, incredibly organised, and a brilliant motivational speaker, so sat down with you and made it very, very clear what was expected of you. Your job, nothing more, nothing less, but brilliant looking in your eye and making sure you understood what was required.
Yeah, Ian Jones, one of the greatest All Blacks ever.
That's very nice.
I've got another message to play from him, but before we get into that, like, how does that make you feel when you've had that impact on someone?
Yeah, that's nice. You never know that sometimes, you know, you never hear those sort of comments. And no doubt going into the professional era was totally new for everyone. And I wasn't always the most popular coach because I had to make some pretty hard decisions, particularly in terms of what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable.
In terms of, how do you mean?
Well, behaviours. You know, the old days and the amateur days, what went on tour stayed on tour. Standards were possibly a lot more average. In the professional era, you were owned by the public. You were in the public eye and you had a responsibility. And I think, you know, that mean we had to change some of the things that were traditional in the All Blacks, and some people didn't like that. Some players reacted to that, but I know it was the right thing and ultimately we got it right.
Because was there, I mean, I've got no idea what the All Black fold's like now, whether there's the back bus thing with senior players or that sort of us versus them mentality with the senior. You look back now under the 2023 gaze, was there sort of elements of almost bullying in a way?
Look, I'm not close to it right now, yeah. but I would think that's well and truly gone,
yeah.
That sense of bullying. And there was that. It was involved pretty heavily before I was involved. I mean, I used to be quite shocked at some of the things I saw and read in terms of some of the behaviour, team behaviours. But, look, professionalism's evolved. People have grown with it. I think you see really a very different attitude now to young people wanting to succeed, to older players wanting to help younger players, that everyone's focused on team versus maybe individual. And so I think, you know, there's a lot more cohesiveness, unity, and in the end, a better product.
Yeah. Well, it just wasn't a thing back then, was it? I remember I was a broadcaster in Palmerston North at the time in the 90s, and I worked in the morning doing a breakfast radio show. Then I was free all day. So when rugby became professional, I became best friends with some rugby players at the time because we all had all this free time. So there was Christian Cullen, yeah. Mark Ranby, do you
know? Mark, well.
Dion Waller, Kristen Davis.
I coached all of those guys. I didn't coach Dion, but I coached those guys, yeah.
Yeah, so we used to kick around together, but I think Christian was shy by nature until you get to know him, and I think he found it incredibly intimidating at the time, yep, with the older players, you know, yep, Fitzy and Carmo and whoever else.
Well, that's only natural, I guess, you know, for young people, particularly if they come in pretty inexperienced as well, and all of a sudden to be exposed to that sort of level of player and everything that goes with it, the aura around them. You do come in a bit quiet, and possibly that's a good thing, because you come in and learn.
You don't want to be a loudmouth.
You want to learn, yeah, and you want to understand, and you know, I think that helps them all grow ultimately.
Yeah. Okay, I've got another message to play you from Ian Jones.
When you're sacked from your corporate job, and they give you the spiel, you actually walk away feeling fucking good about yourself. And that was the way John Hart relayed the news to me in 99. I wasn't playing, telling you everything you can and can't do, what they can and can't do for you, until you walk away realising that you weren't in the team. But to Hardy's credit, he gave me an opportunity, gave me a chance, and I was back in the 99 Rugby World Cup squad my final year under John Hart. So, not only fond things to say about that man, and boy, you're going to have some fun and hear some stories.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, I mean, your corporate experience, like you were a lifer at Fletcher's, that must have prepared you well for those difficult conversations, but can't be ever easy telling someone, sorry, you haven't made the cut.
Never. And anyone that finds that easy,
Savage.
It's a savage, yeah. I think, you know, they're always really difficult conversations to have. I always had a belief that honesty was the most important thing. I still do on those things. I think it's really important that you tell people as it is, and you help them manage through it. You know, I mean, it's not easy. And I remember those times with Carmo. You know, it was a difficult time. The All Blacks were having a tough time in 98, after two fantastic years in 96 and 97.
Yeah, 17 out of 18 wins.
Yeah. And, you know, 98 was difficult. We lost all our experience, a lot of experience, and, you know, we went through a lot of change. And a guy like Carmo, you know, he showed his qualities because he stuck at it. He believed in himself and he believed in the All Blacks, and he got back in. And he was always a real he was a pro. And, you know, you need those sort of leaders. You need those sort of people. And at a time when I think we lacked a bit of experience in leadership, because in 98, after 98, we effectively had lost after 97, Fitzpatrick, Otto Browns and Sam Brooke, Frank Bunce, Michael Jones. I mean, huge amount of experience. Yeah. So people like Carmo, who understood the history and understood what was, you know, needed to be a great All Black, were still very important to the game.
Yeah, so he obviously took that conversation well. How did other players – did players they cry with the news? Does anyone get angry and defensive?
Look, I'm not going to talk about those, odd one that did. But, yeah, some react. But in the end, I think as long as you're honest and you believe in what you're saying, they go away and they'll think it through. Mm. And look, they'll never accept it. You know, players will never accept it.
Well, it's personal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, greatest example for me was back in the Auckland days, and you know, that great team in the 80s era. John McDermott was playing for university. It was after, you know, he'd had a fantastic year. He was playing well for Auckland, but I decided that the time had come for me to introduce a new player who I had huge hopes for. And I had to tell John that, you know, I wasn't selecting him for this next game. He was devastated. Mm. And I can appreciate it because he'd done all he could do. You know, I couldn't ask for any more. And that player just happened to be Michael Jones.
Mm.
And, you know, Michael Jones came in. And obviously, the career just took off. And I'll never forget that game because McD was in the reserves, and in those days, reserves didn't get on. So he's sitting behind me, and Michael Jones had a fantastic debut, scored a few tries, it looked absolutely brilliant. And with about 3 minutes to go, I get a whack on the back, and it's from McDermott. He said, "Did you see that, Hardy?" I said, "What?" "Michael Jones, you just missed a tackle." So it's sort of, you know, and we're still great mates. So, you know, that's, I think honesty and people, as long as you've got good reasons for your decisions, I think you got to think about those decisions and make sure you communicate effectively.
Yeah. Did McDermott say he was available to play on Sundays?
Well, yeah, I suppose that was one of the differences. He'd play any day.
Yeah. So you've had two books out, Straight from the Heart and Change of Heart. First one, Straight from the Heart, came out before you even got to coach the All Blacks. And the last chapter of that book, there's a sentence in there that I want to run through. So this is before you got to coach the All Blacks. "If the coaching career, which I never actively planned, but which grew like topsy and gave my life a whole new dimension, is in fact now over, the good memories will far outweigh the disappointments." I've got three questions from that one sentence. First of all, what is topsy? Is that a weed?
Yeah, no. I mean, all careers are up and down.
Oh,
you know, I mean,
topsy turvy.
Yeah, topsy turvy. Okay. Yep.
Okay.
Not the one you eat. No.
Okay. No. The ice block. Yeah. Next question. You said the coaching career is one that you never actively planned. What do you mean? How did you fall into it?
Well, I never planned to coach.
Right.
I was. My first coaching experience was when I was 18, and I coached at university, and I coached my young brother's team. And so I got into coaching in that sense early, but then I went into playing, and I never thought about coaching until I went to Waitemata. When I switched to Waitemata in 1970, had a couple of years there, 3 years there, and then the coach retired, and the manager at the time, Ray Vuksic, who was a great old guy and a great stalwart of Waitemata and Yugoslav rugby, he said to me, "Why don't you be a player coach?" And I'd never thought of what a player coach meant.
Yeah.
And
you'd always get selected.
Yeah. Well, you'd never drop yourself. But so I thought, yeah, okay, I'll think about that. And I got into it. In 1974, I became player coach of Waitemata, and I picked a very good assistant, DJ Graham. John Graham, the headmaster and great All Black, and he and I had been involved in the Auckland team. I was a reserve. I was never good enough to play, really. I was normally a reserve.
So you're a halfback, but you were quite handy, right? You were never All Black level.
I was an average halfback that was lucky to get what I got.
Okay.
You know, I think I was a competitor, and I think that got me a long way. I didn't have the skills. I mean, couldn't kick with my left foot, couldn't pass with my left hand. So you just wouldn't get by today with those sort of things. You know, I was pretty, thought I was pretty ordinary, but I got a few games.
Yeah.
But so he said, I said, would you come and help me? And so he said, well, of course, he's committed to the school, but he came and helped me. I used to go and pick him up in the little mini on Tuesday and Thursdays and drive out to Waitemata. And that's how my career started. Wasn't planned at all. And following year, we won the Gallagher Shield, won the championship. So, you know, that it got off to a pretty good start.
So you weren't like a massive planner until I suppose it got to the time where you were sort of in the All Black fold. Did you just sort of like evolve and roll with opportunities that came your way?
Well, to be fair, planning and thinking ahead has always been part of my life with Fletchers. I mean, I was, you know, hugely involved in the growth of Fletchers as a company, and I learned and understood man management very early in my life, and so coaching really fell out of that because it used many of the same skills that you require in managing people in a business and managing a football team, and so you know, it evolved from there. And I was really fortunate, I guess. I coached Waitemata for 7 years or so, and then I managed to get the Auckland job, and you know, that was a huge experience. And the interesting thing, looking back, I mean, I was full-time employed by Fletcher Challenge as an employee relations manager of that company in those days.
And it was a big company, right? Like one of the biggest companies in New Zealand.
Huge. It was the biggest.
Oh, the biggest.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I worked for Fletcher's initially. I joined them in 1967 or 66. And then Fletcher Challenge was formed when Tasman Pulp and Paper, Challenge Corporation and Fletcher's all came together. So it was an amalgamation of three of New Zealand's largest companies to become New Zealand's largest company. And it was, you know, at one stage, we employed 30,000 people around the world. So it was a real big company. And I led that HR function for many years.
Towards the end, just while we're on the Fletcher's thing, towards the end, it must have been like you were taking the piss with the job. And the respect that, like I've had Sir John Kerwin on the podcast, and he talks about, we'll get into this, he talks about coming and having a meeting with you with his dad. You were coaching, all right? It was an office for your coaching job.
I don't think Fletcher saw it that way. I'll have to ask Hugh Fletcher, but I don't think he would have seen it that way. But look, they merged, you know. It was, I mean, I look back, that's just not possible today. You couldn't do a job like I had, which was full-time and full-on, you know. I mean, I had a big role in that company at that stage. And here I am coaching a provincial team as well. Mm. I mean, I don't know. I often say to myself, how did that happen? I don't know.
Yeah, were you just busy working, burning the candle at both ends? Like I mean, I was joking before. I was being cheeky. But you were obviously doing the Fletcher stuff well and the rugby stuff well.
Well, I had to, or else I wouldn't have had either. So
it absolutely wasn't one of those. You know, when rugby was still amateur and players were given token jobs. Yep. So you might have someone that's merchandising with Coke or whatever. Yep. One of the big advertisers.
Wasn't that?
It was a proper job.
Yeah, it was a proper job. Yeah, it wasn't semi-professional. No, it was. And I was lucky, I guess. I had really good people around me. I've always been a great believer that if you want to be successful, you've got to surround yourself by good people, better than yourself. Wherever you can, get people who are better than yourself in the areas that they're in. And look, I had at Fletcher's, in those days, I had a fantastic team of people under me at running the HR function. And as a consequence, you know, that helped because I could manage. And I did the same thing with Auckland. I make sure I got really good people around me and, you know, tested the boundaries a bit by challenging the system and changing the processes in terms of who would be a manager, how would a manager be selected. I mean, I wanted the best, not just one of the rest. Mm-hmm. And so managed to get that changed, and something they'd done for 100 years, and appointed a delegate. Club delegate was always a they'd take turns at being manager of the Auckland team, and things like that. So I made sure that you can't succeed unless you have good structure and good people.
Yeah.
And I learned that early, and I've always practiced it, and I do it today.
Yeah, so the John Kerwin thing, he told the story, and I get the Yeah, there's three versions to every story, right? There's his
probably
his,
four in his case.
So I feel like it's a story that he's told over the years, and it's been refined, and it's like a punchline now.
Yeah.
But there's his version of events, your version of events, and the truth's probably somewhere in the middle. But he said, I'm paraphrasing here, that he was a young player. Him and his dad came to see you in your office high up at Fletcher's, and you wanted him to play in the Auckland B team.
Yeah.
And his dad said, no, it's the A team or nothing. And his dad's mentality was, well, if he plays in the B team and plays badly, that's the end of his career. If he plays in the A team and he plays badly, it's like, well, come on, he's a boy in the A team. But you weren't the sort of guy that suffers fools. Like, you're not going to have your arm twisted by some upstart potential All Blacks, future All Blacks dad.
Yeah, I think there's definitely two sides to that story, and I'll have to sort of correct JK. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not far away. Look, JK was someone that I identified through some colleagues. Eric Boggs was one who told me to watch this young guy. He'd seen him in a club game. So, no, I asked him to go and watch John Kerwin as an 18-year-old playing for Auckland third grade, Marist third grade, and he came back to me with glowing results. Then I went and watched him again myself, and he would not know. No one knew. I was behind the end of a field just watching this kid play, you know, in the uplocks. And I said, wow, I don't think I've ever seen sort of things like it, you know, big, rangy, skillful, you know, presence, had everything. And so I then managed to get him into a game, a Barbarian game, which was opening, I think it was the Massey Club Rooms were being opened, and they were having a game, and it was a Barbarian team playing. I was involved in the Barbarian Club. I got him in that team, played Joe Stanley inside him to look after him and whatever, and went really well. And I thought, now, 1983 was 100 years of Auckland rugby, and there were two teams being picked to play a centennial fixture, an Auckland A team and an Auckland B team, which I had to pick both. And they were both playing composite teams from around the country. So obviously the best team, the Auckland A team, were playing all the All Blacks and from the provinces, and the next lot were in the B team. And I decided that I wanted to play John, but I didn't want him to fail because I knew at 18, it was a huge risk. Because he's coming from third grade. He hadn't played a senior game of rugby.
Yeah.
And so I'm putting him into
the big boys.
Yeah. So I sort of came out with a strategy publicly which said JK is going to represent the youth of Auckland in the centennial. So if it didn't work, he could go back to third grade or go back to his club. Mm-hmm. If it did, he's on the way. But so I predict him. His father actually never said, no, it's A team or not. I actually told his father I was going to play him in the B team.
Yeah.
And then I went away and thought, if I'm going to make this kid successful, I got to put him with the best. And so having people like Gary Cunningham in those days, Joe Stanley with him, was probably very important. So it's a little bit of a twist there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They did come to my office, and we had a fantastic chat. I mean, and John was a butcher's apprentice.
Mm.
He could hardly write. I mean, I've still got the note that he wrote to me, which I'm not sure I understand what it says now, Peter, but,
amazing. Why have you kept that?
Yeah, it's just history.
Yeah. Not a hoarder. Hoarder would suggest you've got like rooms full of. But are you like a sentimentalist in a way?
Yeah, I'm a sentimentalist, and I like to keep things that are important to me. And JK was important to me. I mean, right. He became a good friend.
But you at the time you kept this shoddily written note. You didn't know the importance of. You didn't know what he was going to come on to become.
No, but I had a view on him.
Right.
I sort of.
You just hang on to these notes just in case.
No, I didn't get many. He wrote because he couldn't write.
I know you're only half joking when you say that. I mean, we started with those voice notes from Ian Jones. Is it a weird relationship with coach and player? Like, I'm guessing there's some that you end up friends with and some that end up hating your guts, and then there's probably like a large band in the middle.
Yeah, it's probably that way. You know? I'm really delighted that a lot of my friends today remain the team of the 80s, the Auckland team of the 80s. I mean, I have a lot of personal friendships that remain out of that team in the 80s. So I always look back at that and it's pretty special. I mean, I coached the professional era and I coached the Auckland team, and we created a very special Auckland team in the 80s from nothing, with a whole attitude to say we're going to make this professional. Professional didn't mean money. Professional meant how it was organised and planned. And, you know, I got to say, out of that came some wonderful friendships, some very, you know, fantastic players. And if I ever look back at my career, the ironic thing was I coached in both the professional and the amateur era.
Yeah.
The most professional team I ever coached was the team in the 80s, the Auckland team, which was amateur. And I say that because they just had such a we grew such a professional attitude, and we wanted to be the best, and we had great camaraderie, and we did a whole lot of new things, introduced, you know, bringing partners to functions which had never been allowed before. We had a whole attitude to growing a team, and I look back, and you know, in those days we got a pair of boots and a tracksuit. And you handed the tracksuit back at the end of the year. That was it. That was, you know, and no, not a cent. And I just look back with a lot of pleasure and pride, with the memories of the people that we grew through that Auckland team, and they were a very professional outfit.
Mm. Even if John Kuhn was bringing, in his own words, like saveloys and luncheon to the
absolutely post-training. I mean, yeah, but that was part of the – that was sort of part of the – you know.
So you didn't have dieticians.
Nutrition wasn't – you know, geez, we didn't understand nutrition. There was none of that going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's all, those were the sorts of things that made it special. You know, all the contributions made by so many people, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fantastic.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I actually read an article the other day by chance about Steve McDowell and talking just about what a trailblazer he was, because he was in the gym before anyone else.
Yep.
So this was they weren't weightlifting then, per se.
No, yeah. I mean, we didn't know what gyms were.
Yeah.
We didn't, you know, I mean, the team in the 80s, we didn't know what a gym was. We didn't train in gyms. We trained around the rugby field and you ran, and it's interesting that the dramatic change in the body types, you know, as a result of the whole attitude to strength and conditioning has totally changed.
Yeah.
It was all about fitness. It wasn't so much about strength, but we seemed to get by all right.
Mm. Yeah, you did all right.
We did all right.
So speaking of that Auckland era, which was just wildly successful, do you think – that's part of the reason why you were so polarizing with a lot of New Zealanders? Because I'm thinking, I was never massively into rugby, but I was in Palmerston North in the 80s and 90s, and there was definitely an us versus them mentality. Like Aucklanders were called Jaffers, you know, just another fucking Aucklander, and there was that sort of Auckland, like, sort of hatred in a way.
Oh, look, I think it was always there, and I probably, in some people's minds, epitomized, you know, Jaffa, because I wasn't. Wasn't shy to express an opinion or a view, and I think people didn't like that, and then people don't like success, and you know, tall poppy syndrome, loud, you know, was very much alive and well in those days, and
still I'm sure, is, I think.
Oh, it still is, and so that was tough. Didn't worry me at the time, really, because I was more focused internally on what we were doing rather than worrying what others were thinking. But it got brought home pretty much when we went to Canterbury in the 80s, in 83 and 85. Mm. I mean, yeah, it was
nasty.
It wasn't good. It wasn't good.
Oh, I just remembered I had a third question from that first book. So this is your first book, Straight from the Heart. In the last chapter, it says, if the coaching career, which I never actively planned, but which grew like topsy and gave my life a whole new dimension, is in fact now over, the good memories will far outweigh the disappointments. So that was before you even coached the All Blacks. So sitting here now as a 77-year-old man, everything you went through, do the good memories far outweigh the disappointments?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? Cool.
Yeah. Oh, no. Look, I'm really proud of what I managed to achieve and who I worked with, and and I love the game, and I love New Zealand. I'm a passionate Kiwi,
yeah,
and I'm a passionate rugby person. And look, I just was so honoured to coach the All Blacks ultimately. But if it hadn't happened, I'd had such a great time with Auckland. I'd coached New Zealand Colts for 4 years and unbeaten, and you know, had a whole run of you know, success between before I coached the All Blacks again. I never thought I'd coach the All Blacks in the end. You know, I got rejected and...
Oh, time and time.
Three times.
Let's get into that, because I think it says something about, you know, persistence and dogged determination and resilience and all
dumb,
this.
Maybe dumb.
I don't know, just like a man with like laser precision focus. I think they knew exactly what he wanted. So you were like assistant coach in 87 when we won the first World Cup. You're one of the part of the coaching.
I was Brian Lahore. Brian Lahore was the coach, and Alex Wiley and I were brought in as new selectors. 86 was a horror year. Remember, that was the Cavaliers' year, and they'd gone to France at the end of the year and hadn't had a lot of success, and we had a World Cup in March. So new selector, new selection panel got picked in October of 86, and Alex and I were. Alex was very successful with Canterbury. I was very successful.
Alex Wiley.
Chris, yeah. And we came together with and we were assistant coaches to Brian, and he did a brilliant job in leading that World Cup. But I think we had fantastic influence, particularly in selection, because Brian, you know, was involved in the team in 86 and probably was more committed to the past. Alex and I had a very – surprised some people. We had a very common view on selection, and you know, we worked hard to create a great squad for that World Cup. And I think I look back, you know, and I think when we were about 4 months out from the World Cup, so that was just probably January. We wrote down our teams, and ultimately, Alex and I got. I think we both got 23 and 24 out of a 26.
Wow.
And I think Brian got about 17. So that said, we had a lot of influence together in sort of forcing change, and players like Michael Jones, who hadn't been heard of, was all of a sudden elevated, and we had to get – we decided we wanted to play a game at a different speed and a different style from what had been traditional. And so a lot of the older All Blacks, the traditional props and locks, you know, got bypassed, and we picked a really mobile, aggressive team. And so I look back on that as, you know, fun. When we're in the North Island, I would be coaching, helping Brian. When we're in the South Island, Alex would coach. We were never there together. He didn't want too many voices, and he's probably right on that. I think he was a pretty good judge, Brian, I think.
Yeah, because what was the dynamic like with you and Grizz Wiley at the time? You couldn't imagine two more different human beings.
Yeah, now look, there's been a lot written about us as being, you know, totally apart and, you know.
Like personality clash, hating each other.
And all those things. I have a huge respect for Grizz. I saw what he did with Canterbury, and I think he had a mutual respect. We had very similar attitudes to selection, but we were totally different in the way you manage people and what you did. And so, you know, when we were put together, it wasn't going to work, because totally different philosophies of how to get the best out of people and whatever. And I'm not saying he was right and I was wrong or vice versa. They were totally different, been very successful in our own ways. But you put them together, as the New Zealand Union decided to do in 91 after, you know, things weren't looking too good before the World Cup, it was doomed to fail because, you know, it just – we were very different. Mm. But huge respect, always will have that, and we'll retain that forever.
Mm. So when you see each other now, both is like – senior men in the twilight years, really. What's it like?
Well, I don't see a lot of them, but I sent him a note. In fact, I was watching his Wet and Forget ads.
Oh, yeah. And they're on a lot, aren't they?
And I see they were. He had all these old players, and I decided to contact them and said, I texted him and said, look, we haven't spoken for a while, but I've got grey hair, and I reckon I'd make your team if you're looking for someone to join you in your Wet and Forget team. Give me a call.
Nice.
So and he came back. So that's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, look, the media wrote a lot in those days about that conflict. And they made a lot more of it than it was. But there was no doubt there was differences. So there's no point in me trying to – I'm not sugarcoating it.
I mean, you weren't best mates. You weren't sharing a room.
No. I mean, I couldn't quite keep up with his drinking.
Okay. All right. Well, while we're on this, so that was the so during the 87 – did the – so you never won the World Cup. We'll get to that later as the head coach. But did you sort of feel like the 87 success was partially yours?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I think those involved would say that Alex and I made a real contribution, and I know we did.
Yeah.
I think we did in many ways. Although it was really interesting, I mean, the New Zealand Union treated you very differently. Like when they had the photo of the team, we weren't allowed to be in the photo.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. No coaches?
Yeah. No, really? Brian was, but not us.
Oh, okay.
So the two selectors and assistants weren't in the photo, you know, so... don't have an official record of it, actually. I'm sure we made help to make a difference.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Alex and I and Brian, we worked really well together. And that's to Brian's great credit, that he managed to manage the personalities and got the best out of both of us. And I think the success of the World Cup was very much about his leadership of the three of us.
Mm. And then so the next All Black coach after that was Laurie Mains.
Yeah.
You guys hated each other, right?
Well, no, the next coach was Wiley.
Okay, Grizz.
Yeah, yep. Grizz got it at the end of 87. We went on a tour to Japan. I took the New Zealand team to Japan, and he was my assistant coach. And when we came back, the politics took over, and it was always going to be Grizz and not me, and he got appointed. And then so Grizz then went through to 91, and then after 91, unfortunately because of what happened on the tour in 91, I should never have gone as a co-coach. I was, I have to say, I was told if I didn't, it would be the end of my aspirations.
Right.
And so I was put in a pretty invidious position, and I still...
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, I still wanted to coach the All Blacks, but it never worked. It never worked. It was a disappointment. The All Blacks weren't actually going that well that year. I don't think putting me in there helped at all, because Alex didn't really want me there, and I don't blame him. I mean, you wouldn't want someone put upon you. And all of a sudden he's a co-coach, not the coach. Yeah. And so at the end of 91, because we lost that World Cup, I think consequences were that those that didn't like me had an excuse again, and away I went again into the wilderness.
And what did that look like, wilderness, for a couple of years?
Because I got out of coaching, really.
Did you? So you go home, what do you say to your family? Like, that's it, I'm done?
Well, I didn't say I was done. I sort of kept involved in the game on the peripheral of it. But, I effectively, when I came back into coaching the All Blacks in 96, I'd been about 3 years out of coaching. So it was a huge step. But I think the whole, Laurie went through good and bad times. In 94, things weren't travelling too well when I got asked to stand again because they were thinking of making a change to the coach. And it was close, but they didn't change. So I missed in 87, 91, 94. So 95 came along. It was a big risk.
Yeah. So in those years where you weren't doing any coaching, you were commentating, right?
I did a lot of commentating.
Yeah. I heard, you never know if any of these things are true, but I heard that when Laurie Mains would watch like repeats of the game on VHS, he had to have the volume down because he couldn't stand your voice. Have you heard that?
No, it wouldn't surprise me.
Really?
It wouldn't surprise me. He's a southern man. He's a southern man, you know.
So was that a frosty relationship with you two? Or?
It was never, I don't know, really. Yeah. We didn't really have a lot to do with each other. He's a really committed, and he gave everything he had. We had our differences. But when I got the All Black job, I first port of call, I went down to see him because I wanted to pick his brains and get an exchange of information. And he was very helpful in that regard. So you move forward.
Yeah. If you see each other now, how would it be?
Absolutely, no problem at all. See him at golf down at the hills occasionally. So.
Yeah. Does he go all right? You kick his ass? Or
no,
or?
I couldn't. No. he's too good for me at golf.
Right. Okay, so then you finally get the All Black job. You know, you must. I don't know. It must have been a frustrating time for you because you knew your skill set. You knew your qualifications. You knew on many occasions you were the right guy for the job. Yet you kept getting overlooked. It must have pissed you off. Did you feel like defeated, heartbroken, angry?
All of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of us. I mean, I went through a lot of you know, I thought in 87 I'd probably done enough to be the coach, but the council decided – it was very political. Dom, it was – the whole selection process was terribly political. It was who – you know, I mean, it wasn't about – I mean, we didn't even get interviewed in those days. I mean, it was just – it was just politicking, who you know, and which councillors liked you and which councillors didn't, and eventually in 95 there was a far more formal process, and I think that helped me because you know I was used to that sort of thing, and I think in the end, you know, there were quite a few people standing in 95 for that All Black job, but I think probably my presentation helped me, my background helped me, and it's a bit like Kamu's alluded to, I guess. This was coaching the All Blacks in 96 was dramatically different from coaching the All Blacks in 95.
From amateur versus professional.
Yeah.
And I suppose you had the professional skill set from your years.
Yeah, so I think that helped, you know, and finally got it, and it was fantastic. It was on my 50th birthday.
Best 50th birthday. Yeah, December 6th, 1995. And there's another thing that from a personal perspective that I like about this. I turned 50 this year, and it's I feel like I'm just getting started. I feel like life's a sports game, and first half's over. Now it's into the second half.
Yep.
And here you are, 50 years old, just landing one of the biggest jobs in the country. It's bloody awesome. It's cool.
Yeah, it was.
And compared to like Graham Henry, you were young when you got the job.
Yeah, well, it was sort of imagine getting, if I'd got it back in, you know, 87, you know, you were 39, 38. So in many ways, probably was the right time, you know, more experience, and I was a better coach and probably better equipped than I was then. Still, I was still probably learning. So I think, you know, to hear that day, to get the phone call at my office, and we were celebrating my birthday at the office, and got the phone call, and then to go home and have 50, 60 of your best mates there for your 50th birthday, that's what was all planned to. We had no idea that that was the day the All Black coach was going to be announced. And, wow, it turned into quite a party.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And what a run. Like you referenced this before, the first couple of years, 17 out of 18. And I feel like being so Auckland-centric, or at least the nationwide perception, you had to be winning every game. You had to. That was the only outcome acceptable, really.
Yeah, I was under pressure to probably
I can't imagine the pressure.
Expectation. But, you know, I think we did manage the move to professionalism really well. I mean, once I got the job, I did a lot of study on what made professional teams successful. And I studied NFL and basketball, and I looked at the major sports and that had gone professional, and I learned quickly that there were so many pitfalls for players and coaches and administrators. And it sort of scared me a bit, and I thought, I don't think we really understand what professionalism is, because it's not just turning up today and now you're paid and yesterday you weren't. This, as I said earlier, all the responsibilities and everything changes, and the whole media attitude changes. Everything, you know, you're in the face. So one of the things I did in February was hold a seminar where I talked about the role and the responsibilities of professionalism, and I brought a group of speakers together from all walks of different walks of life. Paul Holmes from the media.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Doug Mackay, who was in the chief executive of Lion Nathan. Ricky Ellison, the American footballer, New Zealand-based, who'd won Super Bowls in America. I brought him out to speak and had all sorts of discussions going on in terms of just alluding, this is different, and you've all got to understand, you know, if you now pay $200,000 a year when you were paid nothing last year, you got to learn to live off 50 or 60 and save the rest and start to build your future, you know, because there was none of that thinking. And I saw young guys just wasting money, consumed by it, families taking whatever, you know. So I think that was really important to address those issues, and a lot of those issues, you know, I mean, when you look at some of those sports, the rate of divorce, the suicide, alcoholism, or gambling, all those things that were very, very dangerous and still are out there in many ways, were challenges that we all had to be aware of, and most importantly, we had to understand that we had a responsibility to perform on and off the field. It was no longer acceptable to be anything but presented well off the field.
Yeah, that kind of, you hear about lotto winners that have no financial literacy and then they come into this large sum of money and then it's gone within a couple of years. And I suppose it's the same sort of thing, maybe a bit of easy come, easy go. But there's so many stories about Jonah over those years, like the team bus would stop in a different town and he'd go to a Harvey Norman or Selectrix or whatever it was and buy like a boom box for the bus, or there'd be a young player in Wellington that'd take under his wing and buy a car. So you didn't do a good job coaching him about that.
No.
Let's talk about him, because like from the outside, that seems like the most unusual dynamic ever. Like, here you are, middle-aged white New Zealand man, him, this phenomenon of the sport, a Tongan giant from South Auckland. Yet there's a photo in your book of you and him talking on the field, and you were the spokesperson at the funeral for the family when he passed away. So it must have been a special relationship. I always wondered about that relationship, because I thought maybe you dealt with Jonah through, I don't know, like Frank Barnes or Eric Rush or something, but you and Jonah had quite a good one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, we did, and we worked at that.
How? You would have had nothing in common, though.
No, not a lot.
Just that you're both one-on-one.
But he was a phenomenon. He was just unbelievable as a what he could do. And I look back on his career, and, you know, he was playing at his peak, probably because of his health, probably at 60 or 70% maximum ability, and because of his restrictions. Imagine what he would have been like if he was 100. So, no, he was fantastic. And he came out of... obviously came out of the World Cup in 95 as a superstar.
Yeah.
And he was the face of rugby. And I saw that firsthand, because I was over there doing the TV commentaries at the Rugby World Cup. So I saw what this phenomenon and what it was. And it was quickly evident to me that you needed to protect him, because he was just being pulled from pillar to post. Everyone wanted a bit of Jonah. And so, and of course, we went to Africa in 96, which was, you know, probably one of my greatest memories of coaching the All Blacks, was winning that series in South Africa. And Jonah had come off what a super career in 95 and was struggling with injuries and obviously struggling
With the kidney
problem, which I didn't know about, but was obviously then affecting him. But he had a knee injury on that too. So he never really shone. He got on the reserve bench once in our test series in there. You know, he just wasn't quite what he was. But I used to watch. The public just adored him. And we had to put people around him to protect him, really, to give him, so he could live a life, because otherwise his life was consumed. Look, we kept contact. You know, we were as you say, we're very different people.
Hard to imagine two more different people.
Yeah, but we had a fantastic relationship. Yeah. And
actually, am I just imagining this, or on one of his Holmes TV show appearances, were you there sitting next to him?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's when his marriage broke up, and
when he got married without telling his parents? No.
No, what? No, yeah, I think I'm trying to think back.
Right,
I'm getting old.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah. But there was one time when I went on the home show with him to help explain and help him through a situation. I think it was the wedding that the parents didn't know about. You're right. You know, we had that trust and respect, and I just tragic the way his life ended so early, and
Very much so. And then to hear about the financial stuff afterwards, it's just sad all round.
It was a sad finish to a great career.
Yeah, that's not nice to hear that you guys had that sort of special relationship or bond. Yeah, how do you coach someone like him?
Yeah, well, I think with some of those players, you don't try to overcoach them.
Yeah,
just
let them play their natural.
Let them play what's in front of them and let them do what's natural. But they have to understand they've got to do the dark side of a game sometimes as well, you know. And
what's that, the tackling, defense, the dirty work?
Defense, you've got to tackle, and, those things are a bit different. So, but he always struggled with his fitness because, obviously, of the kidney. I mean, he was the worst at doing, the running test that we used to do. He didn't have the stamina. And I've seen many times at the end of this particular exercise we used to do to test everyone, Zinni and Frank Bunce, Sean going back and running with him to get him across the finishing line because they all wanted him to play and they wanted him to succeed. Little did we know what was going on with his body.
Yeah, so that must have been frustrating. Like, at the time, I'm guessing, but you don't even have to admit this, but you must have been like, shit, is this guy lazy? What's he been doing on the off-season? Must have been incredibly frustrating.
It was frustrating, and that's what I started to wonder. I did. I sort of said, what's he about, because he couldn't do it. The doctor would always, my very good friend John Mayhew, who was his doctor, he was in an invidious position. Because he wasn't able to tell me, but he was the team doctor.
Oh, so Joan and you, it had been diagnosed at this point, but John, he was keeping it a secret.
Yeah, they were trying to manage it.
Right.
And then finally in 97, it all came out, 96, 97.
Yeah, shit, you had some good players in that time, didn't you? You had, like, Jeff Wilson at his prime, Kelly at his prime, Mertz, Marshall.
Yeah, you look back at guys like Justin, Andrew Mertens, Frank Bunce, he was a legend, Jeff Wilson, Christian Cullen, Tana Umanga, Jonah Lomu. And then that's before you go to the forwards, and then you go to Brooke, Zinzan Brooke, probably one of the most skillful rugby players that's ever played the game, Michael Jones, Josh Cronfeld, Ian Jones, Robin Brooke, Sean Fitzpatrick, Olo Brown, Craig Dowd. Man, that 96 team was pretty special.
Hell of a team.
That was a hell of a team.
Were you coaching, I forget what game it was, when Zinni scored a drop goal from the best part of halfway?
Well,
was that during your era?
He scored two big drop goals.
Do you, as a coach, even though he landed them, do you tell him off for that? Or afterwards are you like, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, we were playing, we were in Pretoria, and we'd won the first test of a series, and it was a three-test series, and as you know, no one had ever won a series in South Africa before. In Pretoria, we had to win the series. Or if we lost, we went to the last game in Johannesburg, which was going to be a hell of a, hell of a mountain for us because we'd played 11 tests in 13 weeks, 14 weeks. So it was really, we were coming to the end of it. And we were just in front, and I see Zinni getting himself positioned behind the buddy ruck, and I think no, because the backs were in front of him, and I thought no, gets it charged down, 7 points at the other end of the field. Should I have worried? Straight between the posts. He was a legend. A number 8 drop kicking goals, The only decision he had to make was which foot he used.
And what about Kelly, my old mate? How do you coach someone like that? Apart from maybe not be so selfish with the ball and pass it a bit more,
Kelly was just a natural. Probably the most brilliant, gifted footballer that I saw in my time in just terms of brilliance. The best footballer I ever saw was Michael Jones, I think, all round. But Cully was exceptional, had exceptional speed. The tries he scored early on, he probably suffered a little bit, and as the game changed a bit, and it became a two pivot game more. Fullback had to come up and do a lot more of the reading and running a game. That wasn't his strength. He was an instinctive player. You know, he just did things naturally, and he was brilliant. And you know, 96-97, he had some fantastic moments for us. He scored tries that you don't see.
Yeah,
I you know, I've huge respect for him. You know, 1999 moved him to centre. Criticised, you know, Big Blue. I had Jonah, Tana, Jeff Wilson, and Cully, and four just brilliant, all the best you could have, and we didn't have a centre, and so I worked on Christian's game to say that he was that. Now, we lost the World Cup because of that. So say the experts. There was no way we lost it. No way, because we shifted him to centre.
Yeah.
That didn't cost us. I've looked back at those games. He played well, and that wasn't a problem at all. We lost the game because we probably just weren't good enough in the all-round leadership stakes when the crunch came.
That's got to be frustrating as fuck.
Yeah, well, and invariably, Dom, people got no idea about the background of these things, you know, and they just look at it very simply from
their point of view. Are you playing him out of position?
Yeah, he's out of position, you know. Yeah. Well, who said he's not a natural at that position as well, you know, and I defend that, you know. I look back, probably, maybe Tana might have been a better centre, straight centre than Christian, and Tana did end up there. So, you know, that would be probably, you know, I'd admit that, but at the time...
Hindsight's a pointless game, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't prove much. You can't do much with it. But I don't have any regrets in that way. I mean, I think, you know, Cully would have been... He would have found that tough, I think. But, you know, he's a guy that I've watched grow, too. I think he's grown beyond, you know, out of a game, he's grown a lot more as a person than he was in the game. And, you know, I mean, I think back to when we won the series in Africa in 96 and he was brilliant at fullback. But he had really no appreciation of winning the series in South Africa. And that's not his fault. He was a young man, you know. So it probably was lost on him at the time, you know. He couldn't work out why he would be saying, well, Don Clark came up to him and the because I know this happened, Don Clark came up to him as the players were coming off in the tunnel after Pretoria, and Don Clark had tears streaming down his eyes and wanted to meet Christian Cullen. Now, I don't think Cully would have known who Don Clark was, you know, because that's just, you know, he was a young man, and whereas Don Clark was obviously in our time and before, you know, a giant of the game, and he just loved the fact we'd finally won in Africa because he'd tried and failed. And I still see that photo of Christian looking at him sort of, who's this guy? And why is he crying?
You know? Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
Okay, so then came the 1999 Rugby World Cup, which I don't know. I suppose I was going to say it's bittersweet, but it's probably just bitter, actually.
Mainly bitter.
Yeah.
I don't think there was much sweet in it.
So, so the All Blacks lost to France in the semi-final.
Yeah.
And then in the playoff for third or fourth, which nobody wants, we lost to Africa.
Yeah.
Just moving forward before we park on this for a bit. So for you as an ex-coach in 2003 and 2007, when the All Blacks don't win, is there a little bit of relief in you? Like, see, it is never hard to
relief.
Win.
No relief.
No, but you know what I mean?
Because you want them to win.
Yeah, yeah.
But you say, well, I hope people understand it's not that easy.
Yes.
You know? And you just, you don't have a God-given right to be, because we're supposedly the best team, a God-given right to win a World Cup. It never happens that way. So, 99 was tough, really tough, because we'd come off the back of a really hard year in 98, because we'd lost five tests, three of them by that much, you know, and it was hard. But 99, we got our act back together pretty well. We stabilised. We had a really good success. We won the Tri Nations. We thrashed Australia, thrashed South Africa in the Tri Nations. And then had a loss to Australia in the last game before we went to the World Cup. And look, we just, I don't know, we were okay at the World Cup. We had some big wins. But coming into France, I was always worried about France. And I remember a saying I had was expect the unexpected, and I talked about it in that, for that game, because I thought that's what you had to prepare for, because they'll do anything. And look, by half time we were dominant, and I still got my team talk that I had on my program, telling them what we should do, which was just screw them into the corners and don't give them anything. We didn't do that. We ran the ball, we dropped the ball, we gave them turned over position, and they had 20 minutes of magical rugby where nothing went wrong. Every bounce just went their way. Everything went against us, and the game turned. And we had a young captain, young leadership group, and I don't...
Who was the... Was Tane it Tane? Randall. Right.
Yeah, and I think it's not his fault. I'm not blaming him. No. I'm saying, but we had a young leadership group generally, and as a result of that, we just didn't really handle the turnaround, and in the end we got beaten. And, you know, that was tragic, because we really were a better side, a far better side than France. We should have won. And had we won
the same thing could be said about, was it 2007?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean,
bloody French
but
again.
It's one game.
Yeah.
You know, and French again, look what's coming up. You know, look at...
No, let's not.
Look at this year. I think it's fantastic. We're playing France first up. That's fantastic, yeah.
Okay, so you're the All Black coach. You're knocked out of the Rugby World Cup sooner than what... definitely what you want. So you're dealing with that sort of like heartbreak or numbness or disappointment or whatever. And then... and then you got to deal with everything else. Like, how do the immediate like days or hours after that look? So you feel the heat of the media immediately?
Huge,
yeah,
huge. I've never been in a dressing room like it after the game. The team was shattered because they were hot favourites and we didn't win. Tane Randall, the captain's supposed to do a post-match interview within, I think it's about 3 minutes or 4 minutes of finishing, was in no state to do that. And so I had the front, and you know, I took accountability from the start, which I thought you should do. I look back and I think I got let down a bit by some of the players in that day, but overall, you're still accountable.
In terms of what, them not fronting up? Or
yeah, not doing, probably not playing as they should have, or maybe, you know, going off the team pattern a bit.
Okay.
And so some of that, but, you know, I'd never name individuals in that regard because it's my responsibility.
Actually, you're just pausing here. So we've been talking for almost an hour. That is one thing, it's quite striking actually, that I've noticed about you in this past hour. You haven't said a bad word about anyone. You've never blamed anyone for anything. And, I mean, you're an old man now. Now, if you had any scores to settle, now would be the time to do that. And I think it says a lot about your character.
Yeah, I think you've got to accept accountability.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to. And that was the most difficult period of my life. There's no doubt that I went through some things after the return. It was a horrible time in my life. And it started really straight after the game, and the media were into me. There were certain media who just wanted payback. I don't know what reasons, but they want a payback.
Oh, you can name them. Who?
Well, no, you don't. Phil Gifford was one.
Oh, really?
Murray Deeker was another.
Really?
Yeah. And they just took aim. And I had to take a decision what to do, because most of the players weren't going home. They were staying in Europe and having holidays. I decided that I would, after testing the water with a very good colleague, John Hood, who's was used to be Chancellor of Auckland University, and who was someone I employed at Fletcher's and worked for at Fletcher's in the end, just one person, a very special man in my life, and I rang him to get the feeling at home and should I resign straight away or should I come back, and you know,
yeah, because this was pre-internet,
yeah,
pretty much,
absolutely,
yeah.
And he said it was pretty grim, and in the end, I advised the rugby union that I was resigning. The irony was the rugby union had talked to me about possibly taking a new role the following year, you know, GM of the All Blacks and bring a new coach in, which is something I sort of had a vision on of what you could do in terms of the brand and in terms of the whole thing. So all of a sudden I had to make that decision, and I made it. It was pretty hard. My family were over there. They came home. I followed them. and arrived back, and worst time of my life.
Yeah, so there's one incident which we'll get into as much or as little as you want involving the races in Christchurch. But so when you get back, is there anyone at the airport?
There was some media, not a lot.
Yeah, okay.
But my family were there. And
isn't your wife at the time?
Yeah, my wife, Judy, and my son and daughter.
How old were they?
Well, they were, sort of 17, sort of ages. Yeah, yeah. 18, 19, no, 20, 20 and 20 and 17, yeah. And Chris, God bless him, said to me, "Dad, Holmes DG starting in the Auckland Cup, in the New Zealand Trotting Cup tomorrow in Addington, why don't we go down?" And I thought, well, maybe that's a good thing to do, get out and, you know. And so the four of us went down to watch Holmes DG, who was fantastic. I love horses, so I've had a lot of fun in my life with horses. And he won 13 Group 1s. He was just super horse. And he was the favourite to win the New Zealand Cup, with a race I'd never won. So we went down there. It's the worst decision I ever made in my life. It's a day that I will regret for the rest of my life, and I'll never forget the day because it was horrible. It's quite interesting. Guys, people just abusing you.
You're in the birdcage area?
Right, just in the public area, walking around, whatever.
Right.
Woman, totally different attitude. Woman empathised, came up to me and congratulated me on my career. Men just, there was just this, and I had this the most terrible things ever happened to me. I went to the toilet and I'm in there and this guy comes up to me and said, "You're a such and such," and the words I can't pronounce on yours, but it was the worst words you could hear, and he just spat in my face. And I stood there and I thought, I can't do it. What can I do? You know, and that memory will never leave me. And that was horrible. And, then we go out and the crowd are throwing beer cans at the horse when he goes out on the track. I look back and I think the poor horse didn't know I'd lost the World Cup. I mean,
they're both like alarmingly despicable acts, but in some way, and I feel more sorry for the horse. Like that,
yeah,
that,
I did too.
I mean, I feel bloody sorry for you as well. I mean,
no, I'm not looking for sorry.
No, but I mean, I'm sorry you went through that. Like, I think there's a few shameful points in New Zealand sporting history, and the way you're treated, I'd say that's number one. Stephen Donald being sent a bullet in the post after a bat. I mean, it's gross.
Yeah, that was.
So what was the age of the guy in the bathroom?
Oh, what he do you was. Reckon? Yeah, I don't know. I could see his face at the time. I've lost it now, thank God. But it was just one of those horrible moments. You just don't think, what have I done? You know, I've done my best. I've got a pretty good career record. I've won a lot of things. But yeah, that was, and that led, unfortunately, to look for 2 years, 3 years. I went out of profile totally. I'd left Fletcher's at that stage. I was on my own. I had my own business consultancy. I did nothing for 2 years. I was hiding from the public. I didn't want to be seen.
Did you just sort of have like a fear that if you showed your face anywhere,
just lost confidence?
Yeah, really?
Lost confidence, and obviously I suffered depression, but I didn't know it at that time. I mean,
We
didn't talk about depression.
Not even JK was talking about it then.
No, I remember I couldn't cross the road one day. I was so scared to cross.
Oh, like anxiety.
Anxiety, and, my mother and wife Judy took me to Fiji for 2 weeks to try and to help because they could see that I was in a bit of a mess. And, look, I had two years in the wilderness and really did nothing. And then a stroke of luck changed my life again. John Bailey, the chairman of Bailey's Real Estate, he must have heard that I was struggling. I didn't even know him. Must have heard that I was struggling, and he was organising a fundraiser for Team New Zealand, and the aim was to run a 6-week online auction, everyone contributing items and bidding, and then a big dinner. And he came and asked me out of the blue, would I lead that for him? And I thought, well, yeah, I decided to. I don't know why I decided to, because I had no confidence in myself at that stage. But it was immensely successful. It got me back on the road, and more importantly, he then, because it was successful, he did really well, and he, a month or so after that, he asked me to go on the board of Bailey's, and I became his the first independent director outside of the family to be on the board of Bailey's, and stayed there for 20 years. I just retired a year ago, and you know, I owe him and that company so much. So a great company. I mean, I just enjoyed it, working with them. But you know, you needed a break, and I got a break. And otherwise, I just don't know what where I'd be. And and life evolved again, and I found myself and found my confidence, and you know, went on, and I've been doing some fantastic things in the last 15 years or so. I've really enjoyed life again. It's been it's been fantastic.
I think there's a good message in there, for a lot of people. It's like, you know, this too shall pass. You know, that's I think it was an Abraham Lincoln quote, and things do get better, and you know, it never stays stormy forever. But did you get any professional help in that time or anything?
No,
or
I didn't.
You didn't even see your old mate Dr. John?
No, John. I was seeing John Mayhew, but I mean, we were. Yeah, it's a hard thing to go back and think about, because I was obviously depressed. You know, you hear about it today, and I was obviously depressed. I mean, I can remember that I couldn't cross the road. I didn't want to go across.
Yeah,
You know, I mean, that's pretty bad.
And the alarming thing is, and I suppose it just goes to show, like, the way mental illness works. It's like you weren't a kid. You weren't in you know, you were a man in your 50s.
Yeah,
and you're well established in business, well established in life.
But there was this whole thing in those days. You wouldn't admit that.
No,
you know.
Yeah,
you got to be bigger than that and better than that and
stoic.
I didn't reach out. I didn't know how to reach out. Interestingly, with my background, you would have thought I should have been able to reach out.
Yeah, honestly, JK can't get enough praise for what he's done. Like the courage in speaking out in a point. It's very well spoken about it now. You know, there's a lot of ambassadors for mental health. But
he's done.
He did it in a time where it was courageous to.
He has just been a fantastic achiever for New Zealand. I mean, I've just got so much admiration when I look back to that butcher's apprentice. You know, and I look at what he's done in his life and the inspiration he has been to so many people. He's one of our special people, you know. And
Because of the work he's done, it means you and I can sit here today and talk about this stuff.
We wouldn't be. I mean, he's opened the door. He helped open the door. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely.
And it was so very grateful for that.
And was it around this time that your first marriage?
Yeah. Well,
how long were you married? Like 30 years or something?
Yeah. Yeah. In 2002, which was all through my in the times when I wasn't in great shape. To be fair. Judy and I separated. We just grew apart, to be fair. And
adulting's hard, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was
life's hard.
I regret the way that happened. I don't regret it happening, because I'm in a great space and so she.
Yeah.
You know, and we've got two of the most fantastic kids, fantastic family, and Kay and Chris are so important to me. And I'm so proud of what they've done in their lives. I mean, they're stunningly successful, and they're both beautiful kids. And so, you know, went through a tough time, and my new partner died 6 months later.
I remember
breast cancer.
I thought I heard something about this. I looked for some information online, but it's sort of pre-internet, so there's nothing there. So she was
a yoga teacher,
right? Yoga teacher,
and in her 30s, and all of a sudden got breast cancer and died within 6 months. So I'd sort of life had really collapsed for me again, and.
Your 50s were rough.
Yeah, they weren't great. Great, but you know. Then I've met the dream of my life, you know, Di, my wife now, you know, I was introduced by Paul Collins, Sir Paul and Rosie Collins. Paul became a great mate through, we were on the Sports Foundation together for about 11 years in the 90s. And Rosie, his wife, is Di's best friend, and she had a view that Rosie decided that Di and I should get together, and she planned it, and we got together, and here we are. We got married in 2014, and, you know, she's just a wonderful part of my life. And my kids love her, and we, you know, life's fantastic. But, you know, sometimes you've got to go through difficult times to have great times as well. But, you know, I always look back on my marriage too and say, you know, we grew two fantastic kids, and, you know, I will always respect Judy so much for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what the stats are when it comes to marriages, but when you get married, there's a high chance that it's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because I'm still legally married, but me and my wife broke up like maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And because you stand in front of all your friends and you make promises that you're going to be with each other till you die, anything less than that feels like a failure.
Yeah.
But realistically, if you're with the same woman for 30 years and you have two kids, I don't think you've got to be happy with that. That's a success.
Yeah, no, I don't look at it now as a failure. Yeah. At all. I mean, I just, you know, I just look at my kids. I live my life through the kids still.
Yeah.
You know, Di and I have just come back from Phuket, where my son and his wife, Missy, and the three grandkids, Jack and Bella and Rosie, 11, 9, and 3. You know, we went up there, and my daughter, Kay, and her husband, Dinger, they live in Bangkok. Kay's a superwoman. People got no idea what she does, but she works for Ford. And she's I got her when I was an All Black coach in 99. She needed a 6-week role to complete a degree. She came out of AUT doing a marketing degree, and I went to Ford and said, would you mind employing Kay for 6 weeks just for practical experience? You never had to do this practical experience thing. Well, she ended up being employed. They liked her so much they employed her full time. And she's been running countries. And she's now the president of Ford International Markets. So she's got 92 countries reporting to her. I mean, she's got a humongous job, and I'm just so proud of her. And
I can tell the way your eyes light up and
smile. Yeah, well, I mean, she's just a wonderful success story, unknown here, but you know, she's done so well, and Chris has done so well in business. He was chief executive of Airworks, who are a New Zealand-based company. He grew that, and he's taking some time off now, and his kids in here, and off to Europe to 5 months, and life's pretty good. You know, I just, and more importantly to me than their successes is their demeanor. They're just wonderful kids, and they're wonderful people, and people love them. So, you know, you can be very – parenting's so important. You know, I think if I look at society today, if there's one issue I'd say is questioning when I look at crime and health and education.
Yeah.
It's that word parenting going across everything, because, you know, I learned great parenting through my mum and dad, who had nothing but gave us everything. You know, and I just think there's no better thing in your life than to see your children being successful, but more importantly, being good children, good people.
Mm.
You know, if they're successful as well, that's great, but being good people.
Yeah, how did you, speaking of them, how did you navigate it during the 90s when all this shit
was
tough. Going on?
Yeah, yeah. It was tough.
I mean, they're sort of adults, I guess, young adults in their own right, so you don't need to sit down as you would like intermediate age kids. And how do you get through that?
That wasn't easy, but they were 20, 23, 24, and,
Did they cop backlash as well from...
Yeah, well, no, not really, but... They felt what I went through.
Yeah,
I mean,
no
they
doubt.
Saw it and they felt it, and they were hurt by it. Whether they got backlash themselves, who knows? I mean, they may have. They didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
But they felt for me and what was going on. So, and they were both very strong supporters and stayed with me, and, you know, very important part of my life.
Yeah, that was pre-social media as well.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah, just imagine.
I just don't imagine, Dom. I just hate the thought of, you know, I mean, with respect, social media is life today, but there's some real downsides of social media in terms of what it's doing to our community.
But honestly, every single person I've had on this show, no one until now has ever encountered someone being mean to them in real life. Like, everyone's had abuse online, but no one... Dr. Ashley Bloomfield said the worst thing he's had is someone coming up to him saying, I hope you have a horrible day. But compared to being spat on in a bathroom at a horse race meet, that's nothing. I mean, that is outrageous.
Yeah, so, and it was probably all the other things that were going on that day as well. you know,
drinking and
the abuse from other people and seeing the poor bloody horse trying to say what he got beaten by a nose. He must have known it wasn't safe for him to win. He got beaten right.
He's like, I've been hit by cans. I'm a little sore.
He got beaten by a nose. He ran second.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting because I think Jenny Shipley was the Prime Minister at the time, and she heard a few things that had gone on because we went home that night straight after the race. We went home. And on the Friday is what they call New Zealand Free For All. It's where all the cup horses race again. And Homestead G won. And obviously I wasn't there. I was at home. And I'll never forget that the phone went just straight after the race. And it was Jenny Shipley, who I didn't really know. But she was Prime Minister. Yeah. And she was down there to make the presentation. She said, look, I heard what happened to you on Tuesday, and I just want to congratulate you on winning this race, and sorry that you can't be here to share it, but we're thinking about you. And I thought that was really nice.
Yeah, it was nice.
That was really nice.
Yeah, so how do you process that thing? Do you go back to your hotel room? Are you just furious with rage? Are you shaken up? Are you upset?
Yeah, well, you're upset. I didn't know how to talk about it even really at the time.
How did it come out? Did you bring it up, or did someone else?
I think someone else. Right. I'd mentioned it to someone, and I think that got released. I didn't go out publicly. Yeah. That's how it came out. But you know, that's gone. That was just a bit of a blip in the journey. And you know, I've come back stronger, and I'm better for it. Yeah.
I'm probably dwelling on it a little bit, but I just can't get over how outrageous it is. But someone, chances are that person's still alive, so someone's walking around today, knowing that they did that.
Yeah,
and I hope they feel immense shame about it and embarrassment.
Probably, maybe they don't. I don't know.
I mean, you know, you must feel like this as well, because So when I was in my 20s and you became All Black coach at 50, I saw 50-year-olds and I thought they were fucking old.
Yeah.
And I thought they knew everything and had it all figured out. Now I get to 50 and I realise everyone's just learning all the time.
Absolutely.
Evolving and growing. So that person, I don't know what age they'd be now, but there's someone walking around that is probably mortified by how they acted that day.
Who knows Who knows where they are? Yeah.
How's the rest of your life looking? What do you reckon? Another good decade left? Another good 2 decades?
Well, look, I'm just – I'm sort of semi-retired, but I am working so hard on 2 things that I'm passionate about. You know, I created this tournament, golf tournament. Something happened in 2004. I was invited to play in the Dunhill Classic, the Dunhill, AG Dunhill at St Andrews, the Pro-Am event.
Yeah.
And which was really nice, and because those invitations are not easy to get. And out of that tournament came 2 fantastic things that happened to me. Firstly, I was paired with Eric Watson, as he was the other amateur in my group. So we played together for 3 days. And he put the hard word on me to come to the Warriors, to help him with the Warriors, who were struggling a bit. And I said, no, I could not ever turned my back on rugby. Rugby was my love. And I said no. And the other thing was that I learned about this tournament and thought, wow. You know, at the time I was on the PGA board here as an independent director. They asked me to come on and help them as an independent director. And I thought, wow, some event. So anyhow, it evolved. 2 years later, a year and a half later, he kept hammering me, and I finally decided, well, rugby hasn't reached out to me at all since 99. Mm. I mean, it's quite interesting looking back. After I resigned, I never heard from the New Zealand Rugby Union. Never.
Mm.
For years.
Yeah, and it's kind of a slap in the face, really, isn't it?
Right now, you'd say that just wouldn't be possible today. But
In terms of like the lack of duty of care? Or?
Yeah, well, both, really. Yeah. But primarily just common decency, I would have thought at the time. But I sort of thought, well, maybe why wouldn't I do something different? And so I agreed to go in there, and I had 5 of the best years of my life there. We turned things around. I helped recruit and put Ivan Cleary in as coach. We had some wonderful times. 2011, We had all three Warriors teams in the finals at in Sydney on the final day. Final, you know, we had our under 20s, our reserve grade, and our senior team, NRL team, all playing off in the finals, which was just fantastic. You know, so I've got to say I've got a soft spot for the Warriors because I had five great years there. They made a tragic decision. They should have really done a lot to try and keep Ivan Cleary as a coach. I mean,
He's done all right with Penrith, hasn't
he? Gone on to be one of the greatest. He's probably the best coach I've seen. Yeah. He's a fantastic coach. And it's not lost on me that Andrew Webster, who's now doing a fantastic job with the Warriors, was a protege of Ivan Cleary at the Panthers. And I often think back, maybe if Ivan was still here, we might have a son playing for us as well, Nathan.
Oh, Nathan, he's not a bad footballer, is he?
But I had, you know, fantastic 5 years there. Mm. And then I came off that, and I came up with this idea to run this golf tournament. And went down and saw Michael Hill, and I said, you know, how about we try and run a PGA championship as a pro-am? Not heard of, a big tournament. Mm. And he liked the vision, and he's a visionary himself. And so between us, we employed Michael Glading, who became a really
good friend. I know Michael. He was the boss of Sony Music for a number of years in New Zealand football.
And he's still running the New Zealand Open today.
He's a great man.
We've been together for 12 years, and we created this event, and it evolved after 2 years of the PGA Championship. New Zealand Golf came to me and said, because the New Zealand Open was going backwards and our tournament was going upwards, and they asked me if I'd make the tournament the New Zealand Open, I was really proud of that, because there's no Open played in a pro-am format around the world anywhere. And so we created this tournament and recreated it in 2014, and now it's just a great event. It's international class event. It's you know, it was when we started, I think their budget was just under $1 million and our prize money was about 400. I think we're now at $6 million. We've got international backing. We've got 60%, 70% of our money comes from international, across, you know, Korea, the States, and Indonesia, we're out Hong Kong, you know, people who are supporting us. And it's one of the three biggest events on the Australasian circuit, and it's growing. And it's an event that's showcasing the best of New Zealand. It's bringing huge profile names to New Zealand who end up investing. Government have been a great supporter of a tournament because they see, you know, the television pictures alone coming out of Queenstown are pretty special. And so that takes a lot of my time. And I, you know, sort of went from the Warriors into that, and then 5 years ago, New Zealand Rugby, I got a call from New Zealand Rugby and saying,
the "Long Blues, time no see."
Yeah, just about.
And, remember us?
Yeah. No. Well, the irony was, for the 2011 World Cup, I was actually chairman of a task force. I ended up chairman of a task force to maximise the benefits of the World Cup for New Zealand. So they brought me back in to do something. That was government, really.
Yeah, time heals a lot of wounds.
Yeah, it does.
It's a funny old thing, isn't it? This is something that we didn't talk about at all. But so the 2011 World Cup, what was the score in the final? 7-6?
Yeah, something like that. So 9-7, 9-7.
So it's a knife. Like Graham Henry, he would have been he would have been kicked out of the country, spend the rest of his life in the south of France or
something. Two losses. He could have ended up 2007, 2011. Could have been.
Imagine that. But it's a fine line between becoming a legend and being deemed a loser.
It doesn't
seem fair.
Yeah, no. I think you just got to accept those things. That's life. Mm. But, you know, but then the New Zealand Rugby Union had bought out the interest of the private shareholder in the Blues and asked me if I'd become one of their directors. And so last 5 years I've been working really hard on the Blues, helping put together a really good team, and we've now got a great team of people off the field, chairman, new board, new CEO, new coaches. I mean, everything's changing and it's quite exciting. We've still got a long way to go, but I've thoroughly enjoyed that. And now when New Zealand Rugby wanted to get out of their shareholding, I helped with Grant Graham bring together a group to buy the shareholding, and so we're part owners of a place now, but we've got some great people involved as owners. And, you know, so I'm sort of retired, love golf, still got my horses, and, you know, chair the New Zealand Open and on the board of the Blues. And I'm doing things now I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to do, I want to give to what I love seeing and love doing. And, life's pretty good. Life's pretty good.
Yeah, as it should be. And you sent me a pic last night of your granddaughter holding both of granddad's books. What would your two kids say about you? Are you a better grandfather than you were a father? Do they complain about how you? Yeah.
Probably.
Well, I think if you're doing the grandparent thing right, that's what your kids should say, eh?
Like, grandparents are a bit easier. Yeah, you can give the kids back.
Yeah, I can tell you love it. You love being a granddad, and you're busy doing projects you're passionate about, and you still have so much to offer as well.
I'm sort of, you got to realize, you know, getting to the age I'm getting, it's, there's limited time ahead, but my whole resolve is just to keep enjoying myself and keep contributing and, you know, being the best I can be and enjoy myself. And, you know, I think that's, you know, I've got some great mates. We play a lot of golf. We have a lot of fun, and friendships are so important to life. And and those are the things that I treasure and work hard at.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry you went through that dark patch, but I'm pleased that you've gone through it.
Oh, look, I'm a better person for going through it.
Yeah. How do you mean?
Absolutely. No. I don't look back at that with it wasn't a great part of my life, but you learn to become resilient. You learn a lot about yourself, you know. I think it taught me that
I would have thought you were resilient anyway. Like all those knockdowns when you were going for the All Black job.
Yeah, I think I was, but I think it showed me how to bounce back, and that was important, you know. I mean, a lot of people don't, and I probably, as I say, I owe people like John Bailey, Paul Collins, are some special people. Hugh Fletcher. I look back, you know, I've got some special people who I go back to my Fletcher days when I first started at Fletcher's. A guy called George Fraser, who wouldn't be known to many. He was Sir James's right-hand man. He was a communist. He was chairman of TV3. He was everything, everything different. He was my mentor. And I always remember something he said to me. He said, "For you to be successful, there's one thing you must remember. Never forget the most important thing in life." And I didn't know what I was going to hear here. And he said, "Common sense." And I think I've survived on common sense. And I look back at what he taught me. I'm not an intellect, you know. I deal with people that can blow me away, you know. But I think in common sense terms, I can see what's right and wrong, and see pathways. And I think that's always been quite important for me.
Mm. Oh, you're a good communicator, and you're truthful as well.
Yeah, well, I think communication's half the battle, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and being prepared to front. I mean, I was a bit reluctant to do this, as I told you.
Why so? Just opening old wounds? Or?
Yeah, not so much opening old wounds, but I'm not seeking publicity, really. I mean, I'm where I am now. But when you talked about it the way you did, you know, share your life, and I just think there are lessons to learn. And I think, you know, I came out of a whole background where I grew up in a state house, just had, you know, lovely family life, didn't have anything really in terms of anything. I certainly wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I mean, you know, we had nothing, but boy, I had everything. You know, I had a great schooling, loved Mount Roskill Grammar, you know, I achieved there. And it was all about parenting. My parents were so great, and so I'm so grateful for that. So, and I think I look back, and while I don't want to get out there publicly, but, you know, there are lessons that you can share, you know, that you can share to, you know, good times and bad times. And I thought when you spoke to me, I talked to a couple of people I trusted, and they said, "You should do this." And
yeah, you told me this. Kerry Woodham was one who works at Newstalk ZB. I'm stoked.
And she was really strongly saying, "You should do this. It's good, and he's a good man, and, you know, it could be good for you." And so, as I said to you, I was a bit dubious about doing it, but yeah. I've really enjoyed it, and it's
well, it's mate, it's been a hell of a life, so I feel like it's one that's worth reflecting on, because I feel like even at your age now, you're still like looking forward and looking towards the next thing. But you've done a lot, so it's nice to like pause and look back and enjoy some of those moments, I think.
Yeah, and it's made me just talking to you has made me reflect a lot on my life, and there's been a lot go on there, you know. And to be fair, 90% of it's positive. There's not much that's not. But the 10% make you better.
Yeah, and you think about how many players that you coach that are considered great players, even though they never won a World Cup. Oh my God, the list is too long to name. But I think it's the same with coaches as well. Just because you didn't win a World Cup on your own, it doesn't mean you weren't a great coach.
Yeah, I look back at my record and
speaks for itself.
You know,
88%.
I can put up if you put all my international coaching and all my Auckland coaching and New Zealand Colts, all my first class career, I know that my record will stand the test of any of them. But it's not recognised like that because I didn't get a World Cup. But that's okay. I don't go to bed worrying about I didn't get a World Cup. I go to bed thinking that, you know, I've had a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, that's exactly my point. No one's saying, Jonah, yeah, not bad. Never won a World Cup, though, are they? Yeah,
exactly.
One final one. This might be the thing that gets picked up in the news, if anything. So the Rugby World Cup's coming up. Did I hear you on Hosking? You said something about the Ian Foster thing, like you were asked to comment on that. So you thought Ian Foster was a bit hard done by with the
don't think I'm slow coming backwards on that one. I don't think it was handled really well at all. I think what went on last year when he went through that bad patch with Ireland and whatever, I think he was treated pretty roughly personally.
By the New Zealand public or the NZRU?
Everyone.
Right.
I think collectively, media. I think he took – and I've just been delighted to see him successful. I mean, it's quite interesting to me. I think – the introduction of Joe Smith and Jason Ryan have enabled him to be the coach he needed to be. I think he probably made a mistake in the quality of the people he had with him and having to get rid of his assistants. But he made that move, and he's brought in two world-class people, and as a group now they are looking a lot stronger. And I only wish him well. I had a couple of hours with he and Joe Smith just last week before last week's test, and it was really refreshing. I was really respectful of listening to him talk about the game. He's a lot smarter than people give him credit for in the game in the game of rugby. I think a lot of people wanted to see him fail, and that hurts. You know, I've seen that. And the Scott Robertson thing, you know, that was in the background all the time. I think he's got as good a chance as we've. The World Cup in 2023 is going to be an immensely hard one to win, particularly because of the draw. The draw is right against All Blacks, South Africa, France, and Ireland. The best four teams are in the same two pools. So come quarterfinals, two of them are gone, and you're going to see Australia and England go through on the other side. Australia, who aren't an average team, I'm almost certainly will say we'll get in the semi-finals. And yet we could get out knocked out at the quarterfinals because we're going to have to play South Africa or Ireland to get through. But I've got a feeling about this World Cup that the first game will be the last game.
What is that? Oh, like the final?
I reckon.
Who's the first game?
First game's France versus All Blacks, and I reckon that'll be the final. I think.
You would say that. You've been stung by France before.
Yeah, well.
Actually, New Zealand's been stung by France many times.
And it's in France. They're right up now. Yeah. Ireland and France are the top two teams in the world at the moment. But I think France, the All Blacks, and Ireland, South Africa, they are the four best teams. Unfortunately, two are not going to get through. But I do believe if we win the quarterfinal, we can meet France in the semifinal, in the final.
Are you still fully immersed in rugby? You enjoy it? You love it?
Well, I'm totally immersed in the Warriors. You know, I love that. I spent a lot of my time there. I've created a family foundation for the Blues and, you know, got a whole lot of people involved in that, supporting, getting out and getting some really great names in Auckland, supporting the Blues, and I'm loving that. So, I'm passionate about the game. Look, I'm a passionate Kiwi. I just love New Zealand. I don't necessarily like what I'm seeing in New Zealand at the moment.
Yeah.
It's not quite the country that I love. And hopefully, you know, we that gets turned around. And, you know, listening to what happened today, you know. I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, we're filming this on Thursday, July 20, and there was a shooting this morning in Commercial Bay. And a guy went to work with a gun, and he's dead, and two other people are dead as well. It's awful.
That's sad. And particularly, I thought it was really sad, given that it's on the eve of, you know, the FIFA World Cup, the Women's World Cup, which is a big event for New Zealand. Mm. So not exactly the publicity we want. But, you know, I've got a lot of my mates saying to me, you know, they're thinking about leaving. No way I could leave. I believe in this country, and we've just got to get through it. We've got to be better. We've got to be better.
I love the attitude. I think that's a good place to end it. John Hart, hell of a life. And I don't know if we want to look at it like a game clock. You're into maybe the last quarter.
I'm well into the last quarter.
I don't know. As I said to you just before we started recording, I had Arch Jelly sitting in this seat a couple of weeks ago, John Walker's old coach, who's about to turn 101. So you just never know. You're looking great.
I don't know if I get to 101, but thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed being on the program.
John Hart on Runners Only with Tom Harvey. Thank you very much for making it all the way through. Thanks again to Radix for sponsoring this episode. If it's protein powders, smoothie recovery powders, or freeze-dried, just-add-water meals that actually taste nice and give you the nutrients you need, check them out. Radix Nutrition, radix.co.nz. You can reach me anytime you want on Instagram. Dom Harvey NZ is my handle. And if you don't do so already, it would be really epic if you could subscribe to the podcast. On Spotify, you just hit the little bell and the cog logos to auto-download, and on Apple, just click the follow button. But even better than that, share it on social media if you like it, or tell a friend about it who you think may enjoy it. But ultimately, I just appreciate you listening and enjoying the podcast. Thank you so much, and I do hope to see you next week on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.